Hello. Nice to see everybody again. Hello. Welcome to Big Friday. It's Big Friday number two. Hopefully we are enjoying our time together, but also ready to think really clearly about that story that we've left halfway. We're going to come back to that story in a moment. For those who I didn't get to meet last week, my name is Pete. I spend most of my time through the week working at Barker. I can see lots of Barker uniforms around. There we go. But we love all the schools here. We love all the schools. I used to work at St. Ives High. It was nice to hear a bit of a shout out for St. Ives High. There we go. Welcome along to Big Fridays. I got to unpack some of these stories last week, and we're building our way through thinking about faith, thinking about fear, thinking about the big question, Jesus, don't you care? And we're building on that a little bit more tonight. We'll come back to that story that we stopped halfway in our reading. I'm going to throw some pictures up on the screen here. And I want you to think, how do the people that appear on the screen, how do they use their power or influence? Do they use it well or not well? They're all people who have a big measure of influence. How do they use that power? How do they use their influence? Here's the first guy. Well, interesting take. Interesting take. Criminal charges have been laid. He needs to front up, I think, sometime next week, possibly even hand himself over for some jail time. With all the power of the US presidency, it is coming out that he attempted to use that power to rig some elections. Next one. Dumbledore. The most powerful wizard, I think, in Harry Potter world, the most powerful wizard. And yet he will eventually lay down his life, use his power in an even bigger plan for Harry to defeat Voldemort. Sorry for the spoilers there. Mr. Beast! I've lost track. Some of you guys might know. I've lost track of how much money he's given away. Millions upon millions he's given away using his money for good, perhaps. Depends what you think he is giving it to. Mr. Beast, a few more. Thanos. He gets the glove. And then with one click, he wields his power. Okay, one more. I think there's one more to go. Ooh. How does he wield his power? Okay. We might go to the next one. So that last one, that's Oppenheimer. He's got the power to create this bomb that can basically blow up the world. How is he going to wield his power? The big question of that movie. I'm going to pick up the story now, and we're just going to leave it on this picture for a while because that's really the question, that's the statement that Jesus brings to someone in this story in their darkest moment. And that's the statement that I'd love for you to take away from tonight. I don't know what your darkest valley is. Maybe it's right now. Maybe it was a few years back. Maybe it's coming. But as we track through the story, and I'll kind of go back what we had in the reading, we'll hear this statement and then we're going to unpack. And what I want you to think about in this story is Jesus obviously has lots of power. How does he utilize his power in these couple of encounters? How does he use his power? He's got all the power of heaven at his fingertips. What does he do with it? What would you do with it? If you had all the power of heaven at your fingertips, what would you do? Well, let's see what Jesus does. As we heard in the reading, Mark chapter 5, Jesus gets off the boat. We're following on from the story last week when there was the storm and then Jesus stopped the storm. He spends the night on one side of the lake, then the next morning he returns to the side of the lake where he's come from. Big crowds. Big crowds are there to meet him, and you can picture Jesus in your mind stepping off the boat, and already as he steps off, the crowd are there. And someone pushes right to the front. He's quite an important person, and as when he gets to the front of the crowd and comes before Jesus, all he can do is drop on his knees and start to beg, Jesus, please, come to my house. My little daughter, 12 years old, she's dying. Jesus, please come and heal her before she dies. Now, this man, his name was Jairus. I've said he's quite important. His job was to be the ruler of the synagogue. He's in charge of the synagogue in this area, Capernaum. And if he's coming and begging for Jesus to heal his daughter, he's someone who has enough money to pay doctors and find doctors, but perhaps those things haven't worked, and now he's come to Jesus and he's begging. You can imagine Jairus's relief. Imagine his relief when Jesus says, "Of course I'll come." And Jairus gets up off his feet, and Jairus starts to lead Jesus through the streets to where his home is. The problem was, though, the crowds are very big and the streets are very narrow, so the going is really slow to get up to Jairus's house. You can imagine Jairus's relief when they come around a corner. I don't exactly know the geography of it, but you can imagine he comes around the corner and he thinks, "My house is just there at the end of this spot, at the end of this road. Soon Jesus will be here. He'll be able to heal my daughter and our family will be whole again." You can imagine his relief. But then, all of a sudden, Jesus stops. And Jesus spins around and he calls out to the crowd pressing in on the streets this question. He calls out, "Who touched me?" Now, the disciples, of course, are standing nearby. They think it's a really weird question because the crowds are pressing and pushing in. They say this to Jesus. "How can you say who touched you? There's crowds everywhere pushing and pulling. How can you say who touched you?" And Jesus says, "I know that power has left me. Power's gone out of me." And Jesus continues to scan the crowd with his eyes. "Who touched me?" And then between two people, a frail woman steps forward. The crowd, when they see and realize who she is, they intake their breath. She shouldn't be out in public. They step back. But she comes closer to Jesus. "Jesus, I touched you. I have been sick for 12 years. And instead of getting better, I've spent all of my money at the doctors and now I have nothing left and I've gotten even worse for 12 years. But I knew, Jesus, I knew if in the crowd, if I could just reach out and if I could just touch the edge of your cloak, I knew that just grabbing the edge of your cloak would be enough to heal me. And as I grabbed it, I felt life and strength flow through me and now I'm well again." A ripple of excitement spreads through the crowd. It's a close town, a small town. They knew how sick this woman had been, how long she'd been sick. Everybody knew her condition. And then here she is, just touching the edge of Jesus' cloak, and instantly she's healed. A ripple of excitement spreads through the crowd. But before she turns to leave, Jesus stops her. Because Jesus wants to clear something up. You see, it actually wasn't his cloak at all, as though he had a magic, powerful cloak. Jesus wanted to clear something up. He says to her, "Daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be free from your suffering." And then she leaves. Now, the whole time that Jesus has been speaking to her, Jairus has been standing next to Jesus, watching the whole thing. And if earlier he had been becoming more relieved, thinking, "My house is just down there," now he's getting more anxious because time is ticking away. And as he's thinking in his head, "Come on, Jesus, she's gone, she's well. Let's keep going up to my house. We've got to get to my daughter. She's still sick." And as they start to walk again, now two people come. Important people as well. These are servants from Jairus's house. They walk straight up to Jairus and they have some news. They don't know how else to tell the news, so they just blurt it out straight to Jairus. "Jairus, we've just come from your house. Your daughter is now dead. Don't bother Jesus anymore." What thoughts are going through Jairus's mind? How is his heart feeling? You can imagine everything racing, his hands going sweaty and clamoring, possibly finding it tricky to stand still and even to stand upright. Thoughts racing through his mind, fears, grief, terror, all of it. But before he has a chance to say anything, before he has a chance to walk away like the woman, Jesus holds his gaze. And Jesus simply says, "Jairus, Don't be afraid. Keep believing. Don't be afraid. Just believe. And then Jesus leads Jairus up to the house. When they get up to the house, all the people outside confirm the terrible news. They're crying, they're wailing loudly. This 12-year-old girl has died. Jesus gets all of them out of the way, and Jesus walks inside. Just him, some of the disciples, and the parents. Inside, the house is quiet, and there lying on the bed is the body of the girl, 12 years old. Jesus walks straight up to the body, takes the body by the hand. And then Jesus says, in all simplicity, just two words, Talitha cum. Now those two words, in the little girl's own language, in her language, Aramaic, those two words mean, little girl, get up. Talitha cum. And as he says those words, and as he pulls her hand, he pulls her from death to life. And her eyes open. She starts to breathe again. Jesus takes her down from the bed, says to the parents, give her something to eat. And we'll pause the story there. There's so much in that story that we could take in. We could take in Jesus' words to Jairus. There they are up on the screen. Don't be afraid, just believe. We'll come back to that. There's what Jesus says to the woman. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Be freed from your suffering. And we'll come to those things. We'll see what faith is tonight. We'll see the opposite of faith, which is fear. But before we get to those things, how does Jesus use his power? We picked up on this last week. Jesus has all the power of heaven at his fingertips. How does he use it? Every single time he uses power, it is to care. It is to love. It is to stop suffering every single time. You will never find a story in the Bible where Jesus uses his power just to puff himself up. You will not find that story. It does not exist. Every time he's exercising power, it is to feed the hungry, to heal the sick, to raise the dead, to stop the storm, to cast out demons. It's to stop suffering every single time. And so we see in Jesus this beautiful combination. On the one hand, power, but all that power is controlled and met by love. Power and love in beautiful harmony. Just think if you had one category but not the other. If Jesus was all powerful but not loving, then we could not be sure at all how he would treat people around him. If he had all power, sure, he could do these things. But there'd be no guarantee, no certainty that he would use his power for other people. Likewise, Park Power, imagine if he was all love, only love. Then he'd be filled with empathy and care and compassion, but he might not be able to do anything. It's the combination together of love and power that we see in Jesus on every page of the Bible. We might just flick the image back to the other one and just hold it there for a moment. We'll come to tightrope walk guy in a moment. It's that combination of love and power together that we see. The woman, just think about her condition, sick for 12 years. She spent her money. The doctors have made her worse. She's isolated socially. She's not allowed out in her community. In her town, her little town, Capernaum, she's actually isolated spiritually, not allowed to go into the synagogue or not allowed to go into the temple because she's sick. She is literally cut off from everyone and everything. And yet Jesus, with tender words, brings his power, brings his love, and reverses her situation. The first words he utters to her are, "Daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Think of Jairus as well. His condition, well, it's not his condition, but his heart is a condition for his daughter who is now actually dead. She's gone past the 12 years of sickness. She has actually died. And yet we see in this story to Jesus, death is just like sleep. And he wakes the girl up in the same way that your mum or dad might wake you up on a morning for school. Little girl, get up. And she rolls over and she's alive again. When we put this story next to the stories that we had last week of Jesus calming the storm, now we're starting to build up a big picture of how Jesus uses his power and love in combination. Power over nature, Power over sickness, power over death. 1, 2, 3. Do you see how it builds? Nature, sickness, and death. Those three things are not only things that terrified people in the ancient world. As though we in modern life can go, oh, look at them, of course, they're scared of everything. But think about our time now, 2023. Nature still terrifies humans. We prayed earlier of the bushfires in Hawaii. Nature still terrifies humans. Sickness, 7 million COVID deaths in a couple of months and probably more. Sickness still, with all of our technology, all of our medicine, all of our hospitals, all of our doctors, sickness still is the great enemy of humanity. And of course, death. Death that steals from us friends or family members or grandparents or people in our communities. Death that is so final, still, with all of the great learning and advancements of humanity, nature, sickness, death are still our great enemies. And so these three stories that we've been building on, they're not just stories for ancient people back there who didn't know very much about life. They are stories for today. They are stories for the things that we are still facing. And as we mentioned last week, each of them are a little glimpse of what Jesus can do. Because even when Jesus wakes a dead girl, little girl, get up, that is just a glimpse of his love and power in action. It is just a tiny flashpoint pointing ahead to an even bigger demonstration of love and power bound together. That little rescue of the woman who's sick or even the girl who is dead, just a flashpoint pointing to an even bigger rescue. When this same Jesus uses his love and power to make himself low, 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 the lowest he can go, to hang on a cross and achieve the biggest rescue open for all humans, not from a storm, not from sickness, and not from physical death, but a rescue from being cut off from the living and loving God forever. And that is the big rescue that every one of us need. And that is the big rescue that all these little rescues point to. If Jesus can do this to a storm, if he can do that to sickness, if he can do that to a girl who had just died minutes before, imagine what he can do to a humanity all cut off and wandering and running away from God. They're all pointers to the big rescue. If we were to keep reading this story from after Mark 5 and keep going, Mark 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, we'd land in Mark chapter 10 when Jesus said that he has come not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. The rescue mission that Jesus was on would take Jesus to the cross and cost him his own life. That's the love. And then it would bring him out of the grave, defeating death. That's the power, love and power always combined in every instant in the story of Jesus. What do we see in Jesus? Love and power combined. How do we respond to him? What's the right response to him? Well, we saw it in these stories as well tonight. We saw the right response. The right response is faith. And Jesus teases out the right response in the words he says to the woman and then the words he says to Jairus. Because it's that word faith that gets picked up on in both of the little episodes. First to the woman. Daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Be freed from your suffering. You see, it wasn't, and perhaps maybe back then, maybe people were superstitious that it was something about Jesus' cloak. You know, he had a magic cloak or something. No, 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 that wasn't it. It was her faith. So what is faith? Think about the story. The story gives us the definition of faith. What is faith? Faith is simply confident trust. You see, that's what's happening in the story. She confidently trusts Jesus to save her. Faith is confident trust. And notice when the woman is healed, Jesus doesn't say, oh, now you have to pay me. That's not faith, having to pay for it. And notice that Jesus doesn't say, oh, before I heal you, you need to have a good moral life. You need to be a good person, then I'll heal you. No. Notice that Jesus doesn't make her answer all sorts of tricky questions about God or theology or heaven or the Trinity. Jesus doesn't make her answer any of those things. The reason she is saved is simply because she has trust. That is it. That is the only thing we need to bring to the table. Trust. Confident trust. A reason why I love that story with the woman is even in that story, notice how her trust is, it's a little bit off. It's a little bit sideways, but it's still in Jesus. It's still directed to Jesus. But even when it's a little bit off, that's enough. Because even weak faith in a strong Jesus is enough. What I mean by her faith being a little bit off, she thinks it's the cloak, but really it's him, the person. Notice about her faith as well, that her faith does not just sit back at home. It's not passive faith that says something like, oh, I'm sure Jesus out there, if he loved me, then I'd get better. As though he's walking through the streets, I'll just sit on my lounge, wait for Jesus to do something for me. That's not the kind of faith. Her faith comes out in actions. And so she comes out of the house, she goes through the crowd, confident trust, sneaks up behind, confidence, trust, reaches out, confidence, trust. That confident trust drives her to do something. It drives her to come to Jesus. And that's where he meets her. She brings confident trust. He meets her in her darkest moment and he heals her. What about Jairus? Jairus' example is a little bit different because he's already trusting. Jairus has already come to Jesus, begged, please come, and they're already on their way. You could say for Jairus that his journey is already going along, he's already trusting. And then along the way, Jairus' world falls out. It's while he's already trusting that something happens to make him question, is there any point in still trusting? See how it's slightly different with the woman? He's already trusting and then the tragedy happens. He's already trusting and then the catastrophe happens. He's already trusting and then his world falls apart. He's already trusting and then the big question in his heart is, what's the point of still trusting? That's what hits Jairus. And you think, put yourself in his shoes. What is the point of still trusting Jesus at that moment when the messengers come and say your daughter is dead? What's the point? You might have experienced something like that. I wonder if there's lots in the room who are already on your journey of trusting Jesus, but then the big thing happens. Might be to do with your family or your friendship group or maybe a doubt you just can't get past. Something happens in the world or in the news or closer to home. The big catastrophe happens and you think, well, what's the point of still trusting? Trusting Jesus has got me here. Now everything's fallen apart. What's the point? If that's you in this moment, if you are already in that valley now, if you find yourself in that dark valley now, what is Jesus saying to you? This is what he's saying to you. It's what he said to Jairus in his darkest valley. Don't be afraid. Keep trusting. And that's where Jesus stepped in and he led Jairus up and he brought his daughter back to life. Now here's the extraordinary thing about that little episode with Jairus. I am certain that Jesus could have healed the daughter way back at the start, couldn't he? When Jairus first comes and begs, come to my house, Jesus could have healed her right then and there from a distance. We know that because he does that at other times. So why would Jesus allow this whole kind of journey to take place? Why would Jesus allow it to go slow, 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 right down, down, down? Why would Jesus allow Jairus to go to that darkest valley where the daughter finally dies? Why would he allow that when he could have healed her way back at the start of the story? Perhaps, and just perhaps, by allowing Jairus to go right down to that dark valley, Jesus is able to teach Jairus an even deeper lesson. And that as Jesus leads him up the other side, Jairus is now trusting in a far deeper way. Jesus has allowed everything to play out to teach Jairus' heart something far, far stronger and far, far more powerful. Now, I can't guess what situations you're going through, but sometimes Jesus does that with us too. He doesn't always bring the immediate fix. Sometimes he is allowing us to go through something tricky. He's teaching us something far more powerful. And often it is about faith. Often it is about trust, teaching us how to trust when our world is falling apart. And when we're in those moments, here's what Jesus says, don't be afraid, just trust. That don't be afraid, that's the opposite of trust. Fear is the opposite of faith. Think of each of those stories if there was no faith. You'd have a woman who's just sick on her own. Now she's got no money. She's got nothing. She can only fear isolation and the physical pain. Think of Jairus when there's no faith. The fear of loss, the fear of grief, that's all he has left. Think of the disciples in the boat last week. When there's no faith, all they have is the storm, facing the storm on their own. Without faith, we are left to face this world on our own. And we might think we're technologically advanced and modern people, and we might think, oh, I have no fears. But the reality is, when we're left to face this world on our own, fear is our only option. Even if we can bury it down, the fear is still there. Fear of not making my life count. Fear of not making good connections with friends. Fear of failing, fear of missing out, fear of loss, fear of loneliness. Fear is all we have left when we don't have faith to anchor where everything is going. There's so much more we could unpack about Jairus and about the woman. Let's land with this story. This guy, his name is Charles Blondin, a famous tightrope walker from the 1900s. He became famous around the world, really before TV, before internet, before it was easy to be world famous. He got world famous through doing these amazing feats in the biggest cities of his time. He'd go to London and he'd set up his tightrope across two buildings and he'd walk across the streets and all the crowds would look up. He'd go to Paris, he'd set up his tightrope over there. He became famous across Europe, not just for walking across the tightrope and back, but he would do stunts. One of his favorite stunts was to go blindfolded, and he'd carry his big stick to balance, but he'd go blindfolded back and forward. He once set up his tightrope for a week across Niagara Falls. Across Niagara Falls. And some of the stunts that he did across the week, he one time wheeled over a wheelbarrow. And he had one of his assistants sitting in the wheelbarrow as he went across the tightrope, turned around, and then wheeled them back. Another time he took out an electric stove. He carried an electric stove out, balanced the stove, cooked bacon and eggs on top of Niagara Falls, ate his breakfast, and then came back. On one day, near the end of the week, Blondin was blindfolded, and he had one of his assistants jump on his shoulders, and he's blindfolded, assistant on the top, and then he walks over Niagara Falls, and then he comes back. The crowd, of course, are going crazy when he arrives safely back on the first side. The assistant jumps off, and then Blondin rips off the blindfold. He looks at the crowd. He picks out one man, and he says, "Excuse me, sir. Do you think I could do that for you?" And the man says, "Well, yes, you could. I've just seen you do it." And then Blondin said, "Hop on." Blondin puts the blindfold on. But before he's finished tying it up, the man calls out, "No way." I wonder if you are at the edge of Niagara Falls and there's a guy on a tightrope inviting you, "Hey, hop on." Would you hop on? Of course not. I wouldn't hop on as well. Even if you'd seen him do it, even if you've seen him demonstrate this power, I don't think I would hop on. And there's a whole lots of reasons why I, in my right mind, would not hop on. I guess the first one is, even though I've seen him do it, there's always the chance, what if he makes that one mistake that one time when I'm on his shoulders? He's human. What if that's the one time he slips? I wouldn't hop on because what if there's stuff outside of his control? What if while we're up there, even if Blondin is safe, what if that's when the wind goes or the rope snaps? I think probably the deepest reason I wouldn't hop on is the me factor. What if I get halfway and then what if I freak out? And I freak out and lose my mind and then make us both topple down. Lots of reasons why I wouldn't hop on. There is a world of difference between the tightrope walker and the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ also says, hop on. Confident trust, hop on. Now we might think, well, there's the me factor. What if I freak out? When Jesus takes hold of you, there is nothing you can do to muck it up. Well, could Jesus slip the way Blondin might slip? No. We're talking about the Son of God. He cannot stumble. What about the chance factor, that gust of wind or something that might blow us both off course? Not when we're dealing with the Lord of life. He says to us, look on every page of the Bible. You'll see I can do it. Look on every page of the Bible. I want to do it. I want to carry you through life and beyond. And the invitation is there for us all. This one who demonstrates love and power. He says, I want to carry you through life. Hop on. Let's pray and then I'll hand over. Thanks, Heavenly Father, for Jesus' love and his power and his invitation to carry us through our darkest valleys, to carry us through life, and to carry us beyond. Amen.